We're still looking for the risk-free method for powering our civilization. Homes, cars, buildings that run on energy that is both renewable and does not cause damage to the environment. There are forms of energy that can accomplish some of that, but there's usually an on the other hand. Take nuclear power, for example. The operation of nuclear power plants does not create carbon emissions, but there are other obvious concerns. Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN, invited a physicist to talk about nuclear power at its monthly gathering tomorrow night at the Medford Library. We get Dr. Charles Sinclair first. He has a B.S. in physics from Rensselaer Polytechnical Institute and a Ph.D. in physics from Cornell. In high-energy nuclear physics, as it was called at the time, he's been at Tufts, Stanford, and Cornell. And Dr. Charles Sinclair is now retired to Medford. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
I'm glad to be here.
So given that you come from particle physics, I mean, are you sort of predisposed to think that nuclear power is a good thing?
I first started thinking seriously about nuclear power back in the 1970s. And in those days, people were worried about running out of oil. Now, that's no longer a concern, but it seemed clear to me that the world was going to have to face up to nuclear power at some point, and that we were lucky in that we had a time interval long enough to do it right, if you will. And, of course, that opportunity was lost. There have been the three accidents that we all know about, Three Mile Island, which basically harmed no one, and Chernobyl, and Fukushima. And that has put a pall over nuclear power. But one forgets, right now, there's nearly 17,000 reactor years of commercial power production. There are another over 13,000 hours of reactor years in naval vessels. And by the way, in those naval vessels, lots of people live literally cheek by jowl to a nuclear reactor. And what's happened to them? Nothing. When you look at these accidents, it's important that you look for the root causes and attempt to fix them. And both Chernobyl and Fukushima had nothing to do with nuclear power. Chernobyl was human errors on an unimaginable scale. And Fukushima, I'm surprised heads haven't rolled. It was plain old greed. Japan keeps a record of tsunamis that go back for many centuries.
Complete with markers on the shore, I understand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there were markers in the Fukushima area. In the 100 years prior to the Fukushima accident, Japan had 8 tsunamis that were above 10 meters high. The highest was 14 meters. Now, you're building a nuclear power plant. There were 6 at Fukushima. These things are supposed to run for 50, 60 years. You don't ignore a 100-year record. The tsunami walls at Fukushima were 5.2 and 5.7 meters high in the face of known tsunamis that are well over twice that height. They actually excavated, when they built the reactors, to lower them with respect to sea level so that you don't waste energy pumping cooling water. And it's not like they didn't know or they weren't told repeatedly. I mean, it's criminal. What can I say?
So obviously mistakes made in nuclear power. Has nuclear power generation changed the basic way in which things are done? It's still, you're talking about creating a lot of heat from the nuclear reaction to boil water, isn't that it, to make steam?
Yes, that's basically what happens. And yes, it's changed mightily over the years. And in fact, the driving force was the accident at Three Mile Island, where people basically didn't know what's going on in the reactor. And that led to an enormous reexamination of operating procedures, information that was presented to the operators, redundant interlocks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it had a remarkable effect on the reliability of reactors. In those days, reactors were perhaps up just shy of 80% in good times. Now they run between 92 and 101% of capacity. It's a much safer proposition now than it was.
Dr. Charles Sinclair is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a nuclear physicist. He'll be speaking to Southern Oregon Climate Action Now about nuclear power as an alternative to carbon-based forms of energy tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock at the Medford Library. He's here now on the Exchange, and you can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, you know, as a nuclear physicist, obviously you know how these things work, but it sounds like you have concerns that go beyond perhaps what the daily low-level sort of rumble of concern about climate change and global warming are.
I have very serious concerns. I've looked at the numbers pretty hard. I mean, we all know there are many, many people that will tell you we can get where we need to be with renewables only. And honestly, I do not share that view. You look at the real numbers, and I've never seen any plausible plan to get where we need to be with just renewables. I mean, it's wonderful if you could do it. But
I was looking at the numbers, 20% of American energy from nuclear power, 5% from wind, or less than 5% from wind, less than 1% from solar to this date.
Yes, yes. And worldwide, the number is that a little over 86% of all the energy used worldwide comes from coal, oil, or natural gas. 14%, a little less than 14%, comes from a combination of hydro, nuclear, and renewables. And of those three, renewables are by far the smallest amount. Now, they're growing, and they're growing rapidly, but you needn't look no further than the experience in Germany to realize how far short they're going to fall of what's needed.
So really, it's a case of needing to stop carbon emissions now, essentially?
Absolutely. The International Panel on Climate Change has said that by the end of this century, one needs to eliminate all carbon-based stuff. We don't have any idea right now how to really go about eliminating all the things that are done with oil and natural gas. Coal is the low-hanging fruit. We could get rid of that, relatively speaking, quickly.
When you talk to groups that are concerned about climate change, though, is there a rather instant division, I would think, between the people who think nukes would be a good idea for another sort of energy production that is not carbon-based, and the people who because of concerns about safety and waste, certainly, wouldn't consider it?
I actually haven't run into that. I haven't spoken to many audiences, but I've given a few lectures, OLLI, Rotary Clubs, mm-hmm. what have you. And I find that people are interested and not hostile. I think the safety argument really isn't much of an argument if you actually look at the numbers. As I pointed out, we've got essentially 30,000 reactor years of operation. Does anyone really think that nothing ever went wrong in 30,000 years of operation?
That's one reactor operating for 1 year, year?
Yeah, mm-hmm. One reactor, 30,000 reactor years. Okay, of course things went wrong. Valves stuck and pipes broke and wires shorted out, and nothing happened. So there really is a great deal of redundant safety built into these things. The issue of wastes is a different one, but it's a little interesting. It turns out splitting a single nucleus of uranium delivers 60 million times as much energy as burning a single atom of carbon. 60 million is a big number. One of the things that that means is that the volume of the wastes generated is actually quite tiny. A 1 billion watt electrical reactor running 24/7 for a year generates a little over a cubic meter of waste. You know, you could put it under a card table almost.
And not that you'd want to.
Not that you'd want to, and you need to treat it carefully. But, I mean, come on, you're not going to tell me we can't take care of something that's a cubic meter?
How radioactive, though, is that cubic meter?
Oh, intensely.
Of waste?
Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that's often missed in the argument. There's two types of radioactive waste from running a reactor. One is the fission products, And the other is long-lived heavy metals like plutonium that are generated by interacting with the uranium. Those are long-lived, but there's much less of them. They are weapons usable. So if you just take the whole mess and bury it, you've got to accommodate that long life. It's very easy to separate the fission products, which are intensely radioactive, but which means short-lived, from the heavy metals that sort of last forever but aren't very radioactive. And you can treat those very differently. The really radioactive stuff needs to be stored for a few hundred years.
That's it?
That's it. But the long-lived stuff, actually you can put it back in a reactor and use it as fuel again. It's like everything. It's complicated.
Dr. Charles Sinclair, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a nuclear physicist. He'll be talking about the nuclear conundrum tomorrow night to Southern Oregon Climate Action Now's monthly meeting. That's SOCAN, 6 o'clock at the Medford Library. We have him here now. Join the conversation. 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Do you think in terms of nuclear power as a bridge, though, to renewables or something that needs to be relied upon more long term?
I think the climate change issue, if that's what we choose to call it, is so serious, we have to be seriously addressing it now with all the tools at our disposal. And right now, I personally believe that nuclear power is the only technology that we know how to apply on a scale where it could begin to have some impact. You really have to look at the energy use numbers. The numbers are just staggering about the amount of energy we use. And nuclear power is not going to be a quick fix. But
if people were to fall in line and say, okay, great, let's do what Dr. Sinclair says, let's build a bunch of nuclear power plants, given the current regulatory structure, the current concerns, routing of waste to get or nuclear materials to get to and from the plants, how long do you think it could take?
I don't think it's going to happen, quite honestly. That's my judgment. It's not going to happen in the U.S. China is actually recognizing the problem, and they have a very active program to put nuclear power in place. They're literally bringing reactors online with regularity now. Russia, of all places, is doing a lot with nuclear power, and they're commercializing it. They're selling plants in a number of places in the world. The United States has basically put itself into a position where it's going to be very difficult for it to turn around, I think. I don't think I'm going to see it in my lifetime.
Grab your headphones. We have a call here. Let's go to Amy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking nuclear power with Dr. Charles Sinclair. Amy, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you. Since your guest has sort of downgraded the concerns about nuclear waste disposal, I was wondering if he could comment on the concerns about the Hanford waste at present, which scientists in the Columbia Basin are very concerned will soon be entering the Columbia River and threatening that whole basin.
Okay, yeah, and one of several concerns I see on our screen here about Hanford.
Yeah, of course, Hanford was a different proposition. It's certainly true at the time Hanford started that there was a perceived national need for the weapons stuff. Somehow in the next 40 years, that process morphed into a national need to what I regard as sort of criminally insane. We produced a tremendous amount of plutonium, most of which has been half of which has been declared excess at the present time. Yes, they were not very careful with waste. When they started, they just dumped stuff on the ground. It's pretty well understood how these heavy metals migrate in soil. And the short answer is they don't move rapidly. Now, it's certainly true. Some of the stuff has reached the Columbia River, and in fact, you could detect radiation in some of the fisheries at the mouth of the Columbia from that. That's basically stopped. And they have a very active plan to try to deal with it. It turns out the United States' largest construction project is at Hanford, where they are planning on vitrifying, that is to say, capturing in glass the fission products from this activity, which will then be encased in stainless and buried. Basically, you don't make the radioactive stuff go away. You try to immobilize it, and that, in principle, is what they're going to do. We'll see how well it works in practice.
A couple of other email questions. Grumpy John of Grants Pass asks, if it's so safe, nuclear energy, why are there exclusions from liability for the nuclear industry? He also asked about Hanford, but that's been answered.
Yeah. I think he's referring to the so-called Price-Anderson Act. And the issue when nuclear power got started, the government wished to encourage it. And industry is not likely to take on a new and extremely expensive technology if they don't have some assurance that, you know, they wouldn't destroy themselves if they had an accident. And that was the origin of the Price-Anderson Act. Nobody's ever spent a nickel on it.
I noticed that the Price-Anderson Nuclear Industries Indemnity Act.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And in fact, nowadays, nuclear reactor operators in the U.S. pay into a fund that serves as the insurance for an accident.
Okay, we'll take a little more time with Dr. Charles Sinclair, because I can see by the volume of emails that we have a fair interest here. So join us on the exchange to talk about nuclear energy and its use in the future. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. John and Eugene writes, much of what scares people about nuclear power is ignorance, misunderstanding. It is common to be skeptical about things we don't understand. My question, how do we educate people sufficiently to understand how nuclear power works so they can see its value?
Oh, I think that's a tremendous challenge. And in fact, one of my regrets, I spent basically my entire life, professional life, working for various Department of Energy laboratories, never, mind you, in nuclear weapons or nuclear power. But they had the capability to try to educate the populace. And basically, they fell flat on their face. There hasn't been any effort at public education, and I think this is a crime.
Another question here from Mike in Medford. He says, compared with wind, solar, and battery storage, what are the construction costs and startup time for nuclear plant? If we ramp up nuclear energy, where do we safely store and transport the material when we can't seem to transport oil by rail very safely?
Okay. Well, I think I mentioned earlier, by the way, that the volume of stuff that needs to be transported is tiny compared to the volume of coal or oil. And you can transport it safely. They put it in big steel casks that you can drop from the top of the Empire State Building and not crack open. So you can transport it. Realistically, that's not a problem. And there's places to put it. We all know that the Yucca Mountain place was canceled when Obama became president. This was basically political payback to Harry Reid.
Harry Reid being the senator from Nevada,
right,
where Yucca
and
Mountain is located.
In fact, the DOE testified after that closure at Yucca Mountain, they testified before Congress that the decision to close Yucca Mountain was political, not scientific. It's not that we can't do these things. It's lack of political will, I think, is the way to say it. And as you point out, lack of any public education on these points.
I mean, do you feel like the United States has sort of turned the page and moved on past nuclear power? I mean, there's been no new plant built in how long? And now California's talking about getting rid of its last nuclear power plant. Oregon doesn't have one.
Right. In fact, there are two plants coming online in Georgia now, and there are more under construction in the East. But that being said, I wouldn't say we've turned the page. I think we have put in place enough mechanisms that will block much development of nuclear power in the U.S. for the foreseeable future. A plant here, a plant there, but not like China and Russia and India and other places are doing. And by the way, the cost of a plant depends on where you put it. If you don't have some fraction of the regulatory environment that's in place in the U.S. today, the costs go down.
Boyd in Wolf Creek asks, how much can we reduce energy needs through additional conservation?
Not enough. It's, you know, there are all these developments that happen. I mean, what happens when you replace your fluorescent or worse, your incandescent lights with LEDs? You use less power. But at the same time, if you look at the total energy use worldwide, it's growing incessantly. And it's driven by two things over which we have very little control: population growth and economic growth. And the fact that our population, our native population, isn't growing in Germany and France, but it's a blip. It's not a worldwide phenomenon.
So let's consider plant safety for nukes, and pardon me if I'm using an overly colloquial term there, it's just an easy thing to say, but plant security in terms of not just the operation of the plant, but also in this time of terrorism, keeping the materials safe and not in the wrong hands. I mean, do you think plants can be made redundant and safe enough and take care of security concerns all at the same time?
Yes, I think there's a straightforward answer to that. I mean, we've had nuclear reactors in one form or another for nearly 70 years. And there hasn't yet been a breach in which stuff was stolen. There are tremendous stores of weapons usable stuff, and nobody's so far managed to get in them. The product of a nuclear power operation is intensely radioactive. So this is not something you would drive up with a truck and throw in the back and drive off. You'd be dead.
All right, you wouldn't mess with it, yeah, without having some great personal sacrifice there. Dr. Charles Sinclair is a retired nuclear physicist, now living in Medford. He'll be speaking at the Southern Oregon Climate Action Now monthly meeting tomorrow night at 6 at the Medford Library. It's called The Nuclear Conundrum. He'll explain pretty much the things we've explained here now. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
I've enjoyed it.